To today's episode of Tracy Schott's Voices for Change radio show. Tracy is the producer and director of Finding Jen's Voice, and here at Incandescent, we are helping her stomp out domestic violence around the world, a big task, but one we are determined to accomplish. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, founder of Incandescent Radio and TV, and on today's show, you are going to meet Nanette Chisholm, a survivor of a verbally and psychologically abusive relationship with a law enforcement officer. We know that you will learn a lot from her powerful story and her experience, and I'm thrilled and honored to have you both here on Incandescent. So Tracy, take it over.
Thank you so much, Hope, for your support in producing this show. Nanette, welcome. Welcome to Voices for Change Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me this morning. Or I guess it's afternoon where you're at, Tracy.
It is. It's just barely afternoon. I met Nanette a couple of years ago at the Conference on Crimes Against Women in Dallas, and you were a panelist on following the screening of Finding Jen's Voice there, correct?
Yes, yes.
It's all blurs together, but Nanette has a powerful and interesting story, and she's really kind of trying to transforming some of the conversations we're having about police involved domestic violence. And we know a little bit about the data around police involved domestic violence. Tells us a little bit. Can you share some of that information?
Certainly. Well, as far as data is concerned, it is very, very old. And the last known published data happened around 2003. And at that time, it was reliant on self-reporting. And it was random departments within the U.S., a sampling, that agreed to participate. And at that point in time, it was estimated that 40% law enforcement officers, law enforcement families were involved in a abusive relationship at home behind closed doors. And, you know, underneath that umbrella of domestic violence, we not only have the physical violence, but we have psychological violence, we have financial abuse, we also have verbal abuse. And so the numbers that were tabulated were not strictly physical violence. Okay. It was various forms of domestic violence. And that was in 2003. So that is really, really, really old data. And prior to that, there was a sampling done in 1999 as well.
Wow.
And so when others quote that 40% statistic, and people want, you know, links to see where that statistic comes from, and we provide that, people are always quick to shut that number down because the data is so old, unfortunately. So we really need new data. And I've been on mission to try to find someone, whether it's a student group at a university professor themselves, to try to and compile new data. But it's very, very expensive to do a study like that. It's also challenging to get departments to participate in a study like that. And it's very expensive. And also, there are some colleges and universities, for example, that don't want to participate in a study like that because they feel like they don't want any pushback from law enforcement for a study like that. Oh, wow. And my answer for that is, you know, let's not look at it as pushback or being afraid. Let's look at it as all of us coming together and trying to help one another and try to do a better job and not look at it so much in the negative, but look at it in the positive. Is everyone coming together and trying to do a better job?
Right. Tell me a little bit. Well, I guess one more comment about that data is 40% sounds pretty high, especially when you consider that this is kind of a voluntary self-reporting study. And you wonder what it would be if it were more, randomized, systematic, with control groups and all of, you know, like the way you're supposed to collect social science data, what it would really turn out to be.
I'm very, very curious about that, and so are a lot of other people.
You know, I think that it's similar to what we see when we're talking about domestic violence in the military, right?
Correct. Correct.
It is higher than the general population. And you know, we think a little bit about just personalities, you know, attracted to, you know, military and law enforcement. I mean, it's a different, you know, it takes a different kind of grit
For sure.
to be in those professions, and maybe it correlates somehow with also some of the controlling personality characteristics that we see with domestic violence. I
Exactly.
think that's kind of the theory, but because of the lack of data, how, you know, how much that is borne out to actually being true is speculation, right?
Correct, correct. And it's traditionally been thought that law enforcement and military careers, particularly the more you rise up in the ranks, you're always going to have personalities that are attracted to having power and control over others. I mean, that's just typical of any abuser traditionally, but particularly so when you look more at the military and law enforcement, that's always going to attract folks that have that need for that power and control over others. So it's something that I really wish we could gauge ahead of time as far as the screening process is concerned within law enforcement. Some departments do a great job at pre-screening, and others, there's work and improvement that needs to be done. I wish it was the same across the board for all agencies, but unfortunately, it's not. Everybody has their own standards and practices for the most
Right.
part.
And you know, it's obviously we're not implying that all police officers or people in the military have you know, a propensity toward abuse. That is certainly not what
Correct.
we're saying, but it is a
Correct.
very high percentage. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience, Nanette?
Sure. So in late 2014, I met a gentleman online. I decided to venture into the world of online dating for the first time. And I met this gentleman online. And in 2015, March of 2015, we met in person for the first time. And everything, we clicked online, and then when we met in person, we clicked there as well. And looking back, I can clearly see that there really wasn't a courtship period. It just automatically became a relationship, and it evolved very quickly. And I started noticing early on, probably about 3 or 4 weeks in, that this gentleman would speak to me using a commanding tone, an authoritative tone. And I noticed it and I felt it, but I brushed it aside because I thought, well, maybe he's just hasn't decompressed from his day at work. And so I used to make a lot of excuses because I had no idea what domestic violence was. I thought domestic violence was strictly physical. So after the commanding and authoritative tones made their appearance early on in our relationship, looking back now, I started to notice back then that there were some small controlling behavior that started to make an appearance in our relationship. Things such as I wasn't loading my dishwasher correctly, or I wasn't using reusing my breakfast fork for lunch. I was getting a new fork out of the drawer to use for lunch. I drink almond milk. I don't drink dairy milk. And he had a huge problem with that. He didn't like me drinking water out of water bottles. So he bought me a thermos to drink my water out of. So it was little controlling things that started to pop up into the relationship that I felt. But again, I brushed it aside because I thought I could work on these things with him. Eventually, he started telling on himself. And what I mean by that is, he started talking about previous relationships that he had been in the past. And he talked about all of these women in his past that hurt him. And so that made me feel sympathetic because it was pulling on my heartstrings. Like, this poor man, all of these women have just treated him so horribly But then that conversation evolved into incidents of, you know, a fight at a tavern one evening because he thought his girlfriend at the time was cheating on him with another man. And that evolved into a fight between he and this other supposed man. A girlfriend who accidentally, her arm was slammed in a door one night when they were arguing. So I looked upon these incidents as, you know, he framed it as poor him and the women were the ones at fault. Of course, now I can look back on all of that and see for what it really was. He was the aggressor. Okay. So verbal abuse came into play, snarky comments, comments that made me feel bad about myself. He was an avid mountain biker, and he tried to force that sport on me, which for me, going over big boulders on a little bike is terrifying. A little flat surface is fine with me, but going over boulders is not my thing. So he tried to push that on me, and I ended up spraining my ankle during a mountain bike outing. And after that, I was just terrified to get on the bike, and I would get anxiety, and he would pressure me and make me feel bad and threaten me and say, if you don't like this, this is going to be a problem. So there was always that intimidating presence, that authoritative presence, that dad-child feel to our relationship. And I like to describe these incidents because there are a lot of people that don't understand that verbal and psychological abuse exist. So I always like to give these specific examples to folks so that they might be able to relate and say, wow, things like this are happening to me as well. And not look at each incident as an individual incident, but we need to look at all of this.
It's a pattern of behavior.
Yes, exactly. Patterns of behavior. So this is a really long story, so I'll try to simplify it as much as possible. But he actually, probably about four or five months into the relationship, his behavior escalated one afternoon to him actually pounding on his steering wheel because I wasn't leaving a restaurant fast enough for him. I wasn't moving fast enough out of the restaurant for him. And we got into his vehicle into the restaurant in the restaurant parking lot. And as the minute the doors closed in the car, he started literally yelling at me and telling me that when he says move, I better move. And then he started pounding his fists on the steering wheel. That was the first moment where I felt my whole body felt scared and I shook and my brain stopped functioning. And that was a turning point for me when I started to think, who is this man? Who is this man I'm spending time with? And that was a crucial, pivotal moment for me because I started to look into who he was eventually. Later on, and I found out some answers.
How long were you in the relationship, Nanette?
The relationship only lasted 7 months.
Right.
And a good friend that I had at the time was a DV survivor, and she was also a therapist. And when I was telling her, and coincidentally, her husband was also a sheriff's deputy. So I believe she was in my life for a reason at that point in my life, because I used her as a sounding board. And she advised me that her husband does not act like my then boyfriend acted. So that kind of gave me some clarity that not all cops are like this. Not all deputies are like this. And I needed to hear that in that moment. And being a survivor herself, when I would tell her stories about things that were happening, she started to realize what was happening to me before I did it, even though she didn't really verbalize it to me at that moment. And that was very helpful to me at that point in my life. And so I started to look into who he is later on, because a lot of the stories that he had told me over the course of our 7 months together about his past just weren't making sense to me. And so I started digging into who he is. And when I started to ask him questions and kind of push back a little bit and ask questions, he didn't like that. He didn't like that I was starting to ask questions. And so my friend had told me, wow, at that point, we'd only been together 4 or 5 months. And she said, he seems to be someone who escalates rather quickly. I didn't understand what that meant. And then she explained it to me. And it still wasn't computing in my brain at that point. So I started researching who he is, and I didn't find anything online that gave me pause at all using his real name. Something still wasn't sitting right with me. I felt like there was information out there that I still needed to know. So one night I Googled his nickname, which is the name that he used that when we met online. And I found another dating profile, which was a public profile, actually. And I confronted him about it via text message, and he called me right away because I wrote, "Are you seeing other women?" He quickly called me and denied it. And when he was explaining to me and denying it, my whole body reacted and I knew I was being lied to. You know, that women's intuition, you know, never, 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 never fails. And a couple of days later, I believe, and my friends believe, that I was starting to get a little bit too close to trying to piece together who he is.
Right.
And he actually ended up breaking up with me 2 days after I confronted him about that dating profile. And one would think, from the outside looking in, who doesn't understand domestic violence, that that would be the end of it. I could move on with my life. But that's not how it works when it's an abusive relationship. And the day that he broke up with me, I called another one of my friends who's a life coach, and I started describing to her things that were happening to me during the course of the relationship and how shaken I was. She interrupts me and she says, "Nanette," she goes, "what you're describing is psychological abuse." And no one had ever put it to me that direct before. And she said, "when we get off the phone, I want you to start Googling psychological abuse." And I did. And my entire world opened up. Every single tactic that he had been using on me was listed in every article that I read. And I felt a sense of relief, but then I felt a sense of anger because at that point in time, I was 45 years old. And I thought, my gosh, I'm 45 years old. How could I have let this happen to me? And so it was a lot of self-anger at myself initially. And then eventually that anger turned outward and I directed it, you know, at him. Like, how could he do this to me? So in my journey of trying to understand domestic violence and doing online research, I also started wondering, I wonder if law enforcement officers have a higher than normal rate of perpetration. And so I started Googling that subject matter. And one of the first sites that I came across, or first bits of information I came across, was a gentleman by the name of Alex Roslin. He's a Canadian journalist, and he wrote a book called Police Wife. And I believe he's actually getting ready to publish his third round of that book, because it's been such a successful book for him. And he went around and compiled data from all over the world about law enforcement perpetration. And if you are new to this subject matter, if you are a woman or man just like me who is trying to put the pieces together, the best and first place to start is with Alex Roslin's book, because that opened up so much information to me. And I actually reached out to Alex, like a lot of women do when they come across his book. And he's used to survivors reaching out to him, and he was so helpful and so kind and just really helped me move forward a lot and helped me understand this subject matter.
Well, it's incredible. There are a couple of things about your story that really strike me. One is that you recognize it really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The other is that you really paid attention to what you were feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so often I meet women who just kind of ignored it. When they look at it in retrospect, they're like, yeah, there was this, 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 and this. And it made me feel bad, but I ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So good for you, that you were able to kind of pay attention to those feelings. It sounds like also your support system was really key in helping you.
That is definitely key, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because even the folks that I work with during the day in my corporate job, you know, I would tell people here and there that I trusted, and they were incredibly supportive here at my workplace, and my friends outside of work were incredibly supportive. And that really helps. My heart, I always start to tear up a little bit at this part, because there are so many women out there who are so isolated. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the support network that I have. Right. And at least 2 to 3 women reach out to me every week. They find me online. They find me on social media. Mm-hmm. And some of these women are so isolated and have no support system in their community. Their friends have turned their backs on them. Their families don't believe them. Because how can this pillar of the community who wears a badge, you know, who has maybe won a hero award or two, how can this gentleman be like this behind closed doors? And they feel so isolated and not believed, particularly women in rural areas. You know, they're so isolated. So I'm grateful every single day that I have the support system that I have. Right. And I don't take that for granted, because there are others that don't have what I have.
Yeah, that support system, I think, is so key, and it's one of the things that I hope that people take away from these conversations that we're having on Voices for Change, which mm-hmm. is, don't turn your back on your friends just because you don't understand her situation.
Right.
You know? She really needs your support, mm-hmm. and try to understand, you know, the experience. Mm-hmm. So you were fortunate in that way, for sure. Mm-hmm. I also kind of appreciate how you, like, really became a scholar around this, and really tried mm-hmm. to learn as much as you could. So you're working again with survivors, but you're also you've been involved with training police officers.
Yes.
So
yes.
What? Tell me about that, and what is it? What's your goal around training law enforcement?
Well, my goal around training law enforcement is to catch them early on when they're in the academy process, because I think that's crucial and that's key. Every state is different, but during the academy process, the training for domestic violence varies. And unfortunately, even though domestic violence calls are the number one call that law enforcement responds to, and even though it's the most deadly call that law enforcement responds to in terms of loss and injury to law enforcement officers, the training is minimal in academy. It's either 8 to 16 hours. And boy, oh boy, we need more hours than that, because 8 hours just does not even cover half of domestic violence and learning about that. So I try to catch them in the academy process, and I speak to instructors to try to persuade them to include that in their instruction and their education early on. Also in the state of Colorado, I've met with a number of chiefs of police here in this state, and I've had phone calls with chiefs in other states, but I'm one woman, so I'm kind of trying to focus on my neck of the woods.
Sure.
And I can tell you, I have had a lot of support from chiefs of police in the state of Colorado, the phone calls and the meetings that I've had. And I actually presented at a conference in 2019, the Colorado Organization for Victims Assistance. And I had a chief of police that actually came up to me afterwards here in the state of Colorado, and we're actually going to partner, and we're going to talk about OIDV at an upcoming future conference this year. So I'm really, really excited about that, because not only are they going to hear at this conference my story, but they're also going to hear from a chief of police's point of view what needs to be done, what should be done, and how this should be handled, because this particular chief had an OIDV incident in his department. And he agrees that we need to talk about it a bit more.
Well, and the police officers that I've spoken with who are concerned about domestic violence in general mm-hmm. are outraged when it's one of their own. You know, mm-hmm. there's you know, a great deal of pride around, you know, doing the right thing, and you know, clearly domestic violence is not the right thing, and psychological abuse is is so long-lasting in terms of its effects. And, you know, you were in a relationship for 7 months with a psychologically abusive person, and it's had a lasting impact on you. And as you
it
said,
has.
You know, you were like, I'm 45 years old. Like, why, how did I let myself get here? And why is this still bothering me? It's a really powerful thing when somebody you care deeply about tells you that you're worthless.
Yes.
It's the same kind of experience that children experience with child abuse. You know, it's
Correct.
Like the closer to you, the more important that person is to you, that who is being abusive, the more devastating it is.
It is, for sure. And like you say, the psychological abuse, it lasts. You know, there are still things to this day, maybe not every day, but more than twice a week, incidents that still pop into my head occasionally that I remember. And actually, when the relationship ended, I made a list of every incident that I could think of involving him and his tactics of verbal and psychological abuse. And I kept that list in a file. And in order to help process my feelings after the relationship ended, I wrote a draft email to his chief of police with no intentions of sending it. It was just a way for me to feel like I was doing something. Right. And the relationship ended in September of 2015. And in February of 2016, I still was having a problem moving forward in my healing. Even though at that time I was in therapy, I was doing yoga, I was working out, I just couldn't move forward. And so I pulled up that draft email and I made a few revisions, and something came over me and I hit send. I sent that email to his chief. And I felt so powerful when I did that in that moment. And I thought nothing would come of it, because I had read and heard from other women at this point who never received justice, never had any dealings with internal affairs, with chiefs of police. They just weren't taken seriously. So I thought, I'll just be filed away somewhere and that will be it. That'll be the end of it. But at least I let his chief know who his officer is behind closed doors. About a week later, an investigator from a neighboring county, from a DA's office, reached out to me and said that the chief of police had forwarded my email to him and wanted him to open up an investigation.
Wow.
And he did. And I thought nothing would come of it, because he never physically laid his hands on me. But every time I present, I always give kudos to this particular chief for not ignoring me, because he easily could have, and he didn't. And boy, was I lucky. And I met with the investigator for an hour and a half and told him my story. I brought my list of incidents with me, and I gave him a copy so he could put it in the file. And I drove home from that interview, and I felt a huge weight lifted off my shoulders. That interview was what I personally needed to move forward, because after that day, a lot of the stress, guilt, anger, it was all released. It went away, and I could move forward.
Right.
And not everyone, for safety reasons, security, feels comfortable reporting their perpetrator. But at that point I did, and I think I was still a little bit angry at that point, and really wanted them to know what he did to me. And that was a huge motivator. But I want folks listening today, if you're a family member, a friend, a coworker, it's always the survivor's choice to report or not to report, because there are safety issues that we have to consider. I felt safe because I'd already been very public with what he had done to me. And I felt like if there was ever going to be any retaliation, enough people knew who he was,
right,
that if anything did happen, you know, they knew who he was. So, but not everybody feels that safe or that comfortable.
Yeah. So I'm just so impressed by your courage.
Thank
and
you.
I do know a professor who I'm going to connect you with, who might be able to help you with that data collection. I have some, my questions for you are, So your experience was really troubling, right, and horrible, and you didn't let it escalate. We've had the privilege of interviewing other women who are in marriages who it just kept going, and then in some instances they get shot or beat or other things. So, you know, it strikes me that your experience was so powerful and that you took that the courage to now be a leader in the community of trying to put an end to this. So talk a little bit about what it is that you're seeing in terms of women like you speaking out and getting some response from the police departments.
Well, I've only been in this movement officially since the beginning of 2016. And just in the last 5 years since I've been in the OIDV movement, I have seen more women come forward. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that the media and journalists have really caught on to this. And, you know, every day you can Google officer involved domestic violence and you'll find a new article every day, unfortunately. And, you know, it really has helped that the media is starting to shed a light on this subject matter. Also, unfortunately, due to events, you know, last year regarding police brutality issues coming to a head last year, particularly with Mr. Floyd, and that issue being thrust into the spotlight even more than it already was, I think people are also starting to question the correlation between officer-involved domestic violence and law enforcement officers that might be brutal on the street. And there is a correlation in that. And that is also something that I talk about in my presentation that, you know, departments really need to pay attention. If they have an officer on the street who is overly aggressive, and maybe has multiple internal affairs complaints lodged against them, they really need to start to wonder, pay attention to what's happening behind closed doors at home. Because I guarantee you with 100% certainty, if you have an officer who's brutal on the street, there's probably something happening at home behind the scenes as well that they really need to pay attention to.
Yes, for sure. And so when I talk with my friend who's the professor, who one of her students did her PhD work around the women who are married to law enforcement officers, how they're kind of on the front lines of taking, you know, taking the abuse. So she was explaining to me how people who are drawn to that profession, the military, law enforcement, they have that kind of personality. So talk a little bit about that correlation and what you've dug deep into to understand it better.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start off by saying that I firmly do not believe, based on my own experience talking to other law enforcement experts and other survivors, I don't believe that the training academy for law enforcement is creating these perpetrators. I want to make that perfectly clear. What I think is happening is you are going to have a percentage of people with that power and control complex, that issue, that are going to be drawn to that profession. And I think law enforcement is doing a better job of weeding those folks out in the beginning, but there's still a ways to go in recognizing those folks that do have those issues. I think that as they rise in the ranks, I think that it becomes more difficult to stop them, so to speak. And the more they rise up in the ranks, the more powerful they feel versus the folks who are coming in, you know, at the bottom of the rank, so to speak. You know, they're following orders for the most part. But it's not unusual, you know, to emulate leaders, you know, so that's also an issue too. And seeing how some folks escalate in the ranks, what they did to get there, there are some that will mimic some of that behavior as well. And that's very concerning to me. So, you know, the particular chief of police that my perpetrator worked for, I firmly believe that he knew there were other issues going on with my ex-boyfriend. And I believe that also kind of inspired him to reach out to this investigator, because I believe I was just one more piece of the puzzle to some other things that were going on with my ex-boyfriend behind the scenes, some other power and control issues that he was having with his officers that were below him in rank, without going into too much detail. But there were some issues internally at that department as well involving him, I'm quite certain. You know, it's hard to always weed that out, though, and sometimes people don't show their colors right away. So
Yeah, it's complex, it's deep, it's complicated, it's multi-layered on so many levels, right? I mean, you as a woman feeling intimidated, getting into this relationship where, you know, you only made it, you know, 7 months. I give you so much credit for getting out then and becoming a spokeswoman in this movement. So what do you think are steps that need to be taken? Twofold. One, on the police officer side, right? It sounds like that gentleman who took control of the situation really was doing a fantastic job. And then also on the side of women, what do we need to do when we get into relationships with someone, whether they're a police officer or not? So those twofold question to you.
Okay. Well, regarding law enforcement, you know, they are aware the issue exists. It's just not something that people talk openly about, and they need to have that conversation amongst themselves. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, they have a model policy that they have developed, and it's on their website. It's public. Anyone can view that model policy. And I really urge more departments, chiefs of police, internal affairs officers, to really take a look at that policy and use it to their advantage internally within their departments. I also urge law enforcement officers to reach out, and advocates as well in their community, to reach out to each other and formulate a plan together, come up with this policy together, make modifications to that policy together, and come up with a safety plan for any survivors in their community that might eventually experience officer-involved domestic violence. As far as women are concerned, you know, we can do research and research all we want, but these perpetrators are so clever and they're so charming in the beginning. And I really don't like to put the onus on women to just be aware and constantly alert. Although we do need to take precautions in day-to-day life, but these folks are so good at what they do that we often don't recognize it right away because A, not a lot of people understand what domestic violence is. And B, a lot of people don't feel comfortable discussing it in schools or in their own families. So as women, you know, I think we need to look out for our fellow sisters. And if we see something happening in a friend's relationship, you know, maybe out of fear that relationship will end, that friendship will end, you know, we do kind of need to put the bug in the ear and say, you know, gosh, I just don't like the way he talks to you. How does that make you feel? And kind of start out that way without casting any blame, just to plant that seed. But it is my goal that one day we can eradicate this. And I know that's a tough ask because it's so insidious and so interwoven in our society. But I would love for that DV to be eradicated. But that requires a lot from everybody to do that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, when Tracy approached me to help her promote her work with Finding Jen's Voice and Voices for Change, you know, I'm like, we need to put an end to this, but how? Right?
Right, how? Right. How?
Awareness, right? And just talking about it, bringing it to the attention. I think every woman has been in some kind of relationship where they feel power and control and they don't know what to do. We're trained to be such good girls that, you know, like you said, your heartstrings were pulled on and you wanted to be that, you know, if you just love him enough, that won't happen.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
But then it hits that tipping point where your whole body, you said, you know, went, no, there's something going on here that's not okay. And you had that self-awareness. I give you so much credit for ending it, right? And
he actually is the one that ended it, you know, because I was starting to ask too many questions.
That was
I'm away, yes. Yes, for sure. You know, and if there's one thing that, you know, after talking to so many women who have experienced domestic violence, but particularly domestic violence when your perpetrator is a law enforcement officer, the one thing we want from departments is accountability. You know, hold these folks accountable. Don't brush it under the rug. Don't promote them. Don't hide disciplinary records. You know, don't let them transfer to a new department without making the new department, the new chief aware. You know, in a perfect world, I would love to have some sort of nationwide, heck, even worldwide database where, you know, we can pull this up and look at these officers specifically targeting domestic violence and who our perpetrators are. But gosh darn it, just stop making it so easy for them to rise up through the ranks and hold them accountable for this, because domestic violence impacts all of us, whether we're aware of it or not. It impacts our education system, our healthcare system, our social justice system, our workplace. You know, it impacts all of us. So we all really need to take a stand on this. And that's another one of my many missions in life, is to just get people to be aware of what's happening around them.
I do want to talk a little bit about your conference that you're participating in and involved with that's coming up in May. Would you tell us a little bit about that, Nanette?
Yes. Oh my gosh. I'm so excited about this conference, everyone, because this is the first of its kind with the Safe and Together Institute. They're based in upstate New York. Ruth Stearns and David Mandel. They are angels in disguise to me, because Ruth had reached out to me via Alex Roslin, who informed her of that I'm here and speaking out about OIDV. And she had a survivor that had reached out to her in New York, who was just really having difficulty navigating the system, whose perpetrator is a law enforcement officer. So she started doing research online about OIDV. And through Alex Roslin, he referred Ruth to me, and we just started having this conversation about officer-involved domestic violence. And she realized, you know, what a pandemic this is worldwide. So she started networking with folks in law enforcement, with advocates, with survivors, and she and her husband decided to come up with the first of its kind ever OIDV summit. And it's going to be a virtual summit, and it is taking place May 5th and 6th. Online, and you can register. We're doing early bird registration right now, and early bird registration, I think, until the beginning of April, but don't quote me on that. And we have all of our slots filled for this OIDV summit. It's 2 half days, and
presenter slots.
Yeah, what?
Presenter slots. Your yes. Presenter slots.
All of our presenter slots are full for this particular summit. And I'm so honored to be a part of this summit and to have my voice heard. And hopefully for those who don't feel safe to speak out, hopefully through me, I can also elevate their voices as well. But we're going to have law enforcement experts like Mark Wynn, who is a former Mark.
I know Mark. He's awesome.
He's awesome. He's a retired Nashville Police Department lieutenant, and he does training for law enforcement officers at this phase in his life. So he's going to be a part of it. I'm going to be a part of it. Tom Tremblay, I hope I'm saying his last name correctly. He is a retired law enforcement officer as well, and his area of focus is law enforcement officers that perpetrate domestic violence and sexual assault. So he's going to be speaking as well. Other survivors, I believe Leonore Johnson, if you want to Google Leonore, L-E-N-O-R-E Johnson, she's a sociologist, and she did an early study about OIDV. I believe it was back in 1999, and she also spoke to the FBI about law enforcement officers that perpetrate. So she's going to be presenting, and I'm really excited about this, because this is something that we've all wanted for a very long time, to have our voices elevated through a platform like this. And Safe and Together Institute has decided to take this platform on, and they are worldwide. So we're going to have people from all over the world watching.
Very cool. Well, congratulations. It's the first, it really
first
is
ever.
The first ever conference solely talking about officer involved domestic violence.
Yes.
Thank you so much for
bringing
this to light and helping people understand it. You know, there's a lot of talk about police, and unfortunately, a lot of it hasn't been very flattering over the last year. But I think that you're demonstrating that getting police involved in fighting the problem is key,
it's key
to making it going away.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
And we're actually doing a webinar on March 11th with some of our friends from CCAW, including Kara Breeden and Kelsey McKay.
Yes.
And we're going to be talking about how community organizations can work with police to fight domestic violence in a way that's more victim-centric.
Wonderful.
So we're talking, and we're calling it Beyond Defunding. Like, wait, let's take that conversation to the next level, right?
Sure.
What does that mean? So I'm really excited to be bringing these important conversations to light, and I'm so happy that you were able to join us.
One last question for Nanette, if that's okay. Tell us about your life now, your personal life. How are you feeling? Do you feel less traumatized? The work.
I do. Yeah, I feel less traumatized. I still suffer some vicarious trauma through listening to other stories, like we all do from time to time, but I have that under control. My personal life is great. I'm happy. My day job, my corporate career, same company I've been with since 2003. They're very supportive. I'm very happy here. My friends, I have plenty of friends. I can't wait till this COVID business is over with so we can all take a trip together. I really want to go to Spain, but I'm not going yet because I don't want to get stuck over there in case there's a major another outbreak. But life is good. I don't have any complaints. I enjoy my life. I'm living in a community that I love. And, I just, the sky's the limit at this point. And my focus is on maintaining my career here at my corporate job, but also escalating my advocacy and activism in the world of OIDV. So, no complaints.
Well, I thank you so much for your words of wisdom, and I hope that everybody kind of really can take away that if you know somebody who's involved, particularly in OIDV, but any kind of domestic violence, be supportive, be a friend. You're the key to helping her leave.
Yes.
And it's okay to it's okay to call it domestic violence even when you don't have broken bones and black eyes.
Correct. Correct.
Thanks so much.
Yes,
Thanks.
thank you, ladies.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure. Nanette Chisholm, and she is just an incredible advocate for officer
Involved.
involved domestic abuse, domestic violence. Then their summit, my fifth and sixth, will bring you more information about that. Thank you, Tracy Schott. Amazing talk later.
Yeah, and I do want to give everybody a heads up. Next week, March 9th, we're going to be interviewing Jackson Katz, who is going to be talking to us about the role of men in ending domestic violence. He's a nationally known speaker, and we're really thrilled to have him. So keep following us, and thanks for doing the hard work. Thanks, Nanette. Thanks, Hope.
Thank you.